Hi, I'm Christoph Trochner, and I'm on Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Mr. Ben Rock. How are you?
I'm doing ducky. How are you doing there, Senior Ilya Friedman?
Yeah, you know, it's like they say in The Big Lebowski, sometimes you eat the bar, and sometimes the bar eats you.
So who ate whom this time?
Oh, the bar ate me.
That's fair.
Christoph Trochner is on the show today. I was the one to be sure to say that. I wasn't going to force you to try to pronounce Christoph's name.
Christoph Trochner?
Trochner. Oh, look at you. You did it. You totally did it. Well, well done, sir. He, of course, is the DP for the earliest episodes of Baby Reindeer.
And holy crap. Very, very cool. Very controversial show.
Very cool and controversial show. And also just really great show. And I think we should probably just slide straight into Close Focus.
And now, Close Focus.
Because there is this controversy, this sort of like brewing controversy that's been going on since April when the show premiered. It's now June. And essentially, the number one sort of like biggest controversy about Baby Reindeer is that the stalker from the show, the real life person that the show has based the story on, came forward and is suing Netflix for $170 million.
Would you expect any less?
Maybe. I don't know. It's defamation of character. There's a bunch of things. It's in a UK court. I don't know. I thought maybe 100 million? 170 million? Is that excessive? I don't know. But regardless,
it's an Overton window thing because they start with 170 million and then they let you talk them down to 100 million.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. So Fiona Harvey is the real life person that the character of Martha is based on. She was outed via people who researched her, I guess, on Twitter and some of her tweets. And then basically she felt she had to come forward and clear her name because she was getting death threats from people who immediately, she says, believed that she was exactly like the portrayal of the character in Baby Reindeer. So it's had a bit of a chilling effect, actually, in the UK. The BBC has several sort of like biopics based on true stories sort of thing right now. And there's an extra vetting process going on to make sure that they don't experience sort of a Netflix level calamity as Netflix has.
Okay, so maybe you understand this better than I do. But like, I think back to I believe it was the 1980s where Meryl Streep portrayed Karen Silkwood in the movie Silkwood.
Sure.
And
it's where the famous term Silkwood shower comes from.
Yeah. But also because that was a true story about a real person and a real company, to make sure that there was no way to litigate against any of that movie, they had to lawyer the crap out of that script within an inch of its life, supposedly, so that it was bulletproof and there was nothing anyone could refute. Now, making a show like a Baby Reindeer, which is, it's a dark, but it's an entertainment show about a person's character, not a company. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it'd be one thing if you were doing something about the Dow Chemical Company. It's another thing entirely that you're just basically impugning the character of one person, even though you have fictionalized them, but you're saying it's a true story. Like, you could make Baby Reindeer and call it all fiction and nobody would be upset about it and nobody would come after you. But correct. when you say this is all based on a true story, then I feel like it's incumbent on Netflix to lawyer the crap out of that script before they give it the green light.
I would agree. And Richard Gadd, the creator and star of the series, you know, I think he's really leaned into it because, you know, the whole show is sort of based on earlier work that he had done for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And that plays prominently inside of Baby Reindeer. And I think part of what makes his humor and the story compelling is the fact that he's saying, based on a true story, that these are his, like, you know, we understand it's fictionalized to a certain degree, but if it's going to be based on something, and there's a lot of trauma that goes on in the show, if it's all just fiction, it doesn't have the same impact as I think that exactly what Netflix is playing upon is the idea of this is something true that it was.
But then you got to get life rights. Then you have to go and reach out to the person and get the rights to do it. I mean, there's just no, if you're going to claim it's a true story, then yeah. You've got to get the rights from the people who are doing it. So look, it's above my pay grade to say how much Netflix should get sued for this, or if Netflix should be sued for it. But it just does seem to me like someone was playing a little fast and loose with the legalities of, you know, if you're going to go after a company for money, Netflix seems like a pretty stationary target. They're rich. They make a lot of stuff. And if they're going to get sloppy with it, you know, that's the problem. That's a problem for them.
And it's interesting, too, because, of course, Fiona Harvey does not name Richard Gadd in her lawsuit, only Netflix. So, yeah, she's not going after him. And ultimately, he's sort of the creative author behind the story.
But we all know that when you're a writer of something and you sell your idea to somebody, they become the author. So Netflix is technically the author. That's how authorship works in our screwed up business. So you write a script and you sell it to Universal Studios. Universal Studios is the author of that script.
Yes, of course. But it seems like Richard Gadd might have still been named, since it sprung from his brain. It seems like he still might have been named in the lawsuit. And it seems like that's who she was taking, you know, real aim at in her vitriol when she was on Piers Morgan. There's all kinds of stuff on YouTube that you can watch. You can watch the Piers Morgan interview. But I gotta say, it's like, yeah, Netflix has got the deep pockets. Netflix, sure, the author of the series. And if they didn't do their due diligence, if they didn't supply the correct rights and clearances, then they had to know that this was coming. But here's the other thing, too. It wouldn't be the first time that people in Hollywood courted controversy in order to get more viewership. Do you think that that's what Netflix purposely did here? Do you think that was part of their game?
I mean, it's an interesting thought. I don't think that any part of anyone's game would be to get sued for $170 million. That just seems bonkers, but I've heard weirder. But the thing is that I see that they would go after Netflix, but then the creator of the show is going to have a hard time getting his next thing done if he cost his last boss $170 million in a lawsuit.
100% correct. So who knows what is going to happen with this, but something tells me that there is going to be a undisclosed settlement out of court and it'll all just go away.
I mean, that's how these things usually go down. And I don't know. I've never sued anyone, so it's hard. I can't speak to this, but I imagine if somebody came by and was like, I will make you a millionaire, I'd be like, all right, sure.
And then all of it went away.
Settled. I don't know.
All right. Well, Ben, we know exactly your price point now. So we know.
Oh, that, yeah. I'm on the market. You can just put me on Temu and, you know, put that barcode right on me there.
All right. So why don't we get to the interview with Krzysztof Trajnar?
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Krzysztof Trajnar, and he is the cinematographer for the hit Netflix television series Baby Reindeer. Krzysztof, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Hey, Ilya. Thank you for having me.
I'm really glad to have you on the show. There has not been many things lately that I felt really was different on television, like a television series that I really felt like was different and moved the needle in some way that was not, that was a water cooler show, a show that caused people to talk about it in all kinds of different capacities, but particularly how cringy and how the type of emotions that you feel when watching it, like Baby Reindeer. Baby Reindeer is really unique in this regard. Tell us a little bit about how you came to this project. How did you come on board?
So I know Veronica Tofilska, who's the lead director on the show. We know each other from film school, and we go way back, all the way back to Poland. She got the project, and at that time, I was really wanting to do more narrative because after film school, I was doing a lot of advertising, and somehow she managed to invite me to the interview, and yeah, I got the job, which was good.
That is great. And, you know, it's one of those things, too. It's like people talk about for entrepreneurs all the time. Oh, it's not, you know, it's you're not your net worth. It's the value of your network. And it's never been more true than I would say in the film industry in particular. It's who you know. And it's great that you knew this person from Poland and then ended up going to school together. And then, of course, the opportunity came to her and then the opportunity comes to you. That's very much how the industry goes. For our listeners and viewers who have never seen Baby Reindeer and don't know what it is, how would you describe it?
Well, it's a show about this struggling comedian who is really stuck in his life. And then one day this woman comes in and she asks for a tea and he gives it to her. And that kind of sparks this very strange relationship between two people. And I guess it's going into very dark places at the same time.
It is very intense, and I think you did a wonderful job encapsulating the gist of the show. The show is written and stars Richard Gadd, who it's based on his actual life events, where he used to do this fringe festival sort of one man show, and it's turned into this like semi-autobiographical sort of dark story about this time in his life. It's powerful. And when you say dark, it is dark. And I have to say that as uncomfortable as people might be watching it, there's also a lot of fun and humor. And Richard Gadd's character himself is a struggling comedian. And so when he meets this the stalker who laughs at everything he says, it's sort of like this incredible codependent relationship that happens where, you know, even though this woman is super not healthy for him, the laughter is so, I want to say, like, addictive, and that's not something that he's getting in his career at the time. It starts this really sort of like long-winded and bizarre relationship, which I have to say, the cinematography, the work that you do, really underlines and really reinforces this codependent relationship in your shot reverse shots and the way that things move from place to place. I have to say that, you know, obviously there's a lot of wider angle lenses and a lot of putting the camera very close to people's faces, and the juxtapositions that happen in this show back and forth is, to me, a real highlight. It's really it's beautiful to watch, and it really suggests moments that are off kilter and that are a little bit not, you know, as it should be. Can you talk a little bit about the use of the wide angle lenses and the use of the camera placement and what it is that you're trying to evoke and how you attenuate and modify that through the show?
Yeah, one thing first worth mentioning is the show is based on a theater play, actually two theater plays, one-man shows that Richard did before writing a TV series. Mm-hmm. And that also takes part in our preparation because I listened to an audio recording of the show after reading the script. And it was quite apparent at the time that the rhythm it had and intensity it had influenced my thinking about it, or maybe helped me imagine the what it will feel like, what the show will feel like. It was all about how we create that intensity and how we create the intrusion of Martha, how we show through movement and blocking her sort of omnipresence in that pub, and how she like follows him and gets in the way of his, and, you know, stalks him in the canal on the way back. There's like, literally, he can't get rid of her. And so then obviously there was that feeling of, well, it all has to be really close and really intense that you cannot almost, as an audience, you feel that intrusion. Veronica loves Coen Brothers movies, you know, like, and I do as well. Like, and there is no, like, you don't really see a long lens there, or, I don't know, Magnolia, or, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson films. I think there's like that, you know, it's that feeling of being with characters. It always, and I think the wide angle lens always helps that. And especially in this case, because it was first person point of view, the script was Donnie's narrative all the time. We would never start a scene from perspective of anyone else, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. There's some wonderful surprise moments too, and almost like montages of the sequences of stalking, where Martha surprises Donnie, and she keeps appearing at the pub, and she's coming into his life, yeah. And all of these intrusions and all of these ways so repeatedly. To me, it felt like really, really great use of Steadicam. It seemed to me like you were often floating or flying or moving past, and like you were with Donnie, and then suddenly it's like, whoop, and here's Martha, and Martha enters. I can't think of another show that I've seen recently that had, and I'm not saying that the entire series is on Steadicam, but there's a lot of Steadicam. Yeah. There's a lot of small movements, interesting movements, and then also rather grand movements of tracking people through the streets and tracking people at night. Can you talk about moving the camera and how moving the camera puts you more in you know, Donnie's world?
Yeah, no. So I think that we kind of knew that the camera had to be attached to Donnie. And we love the film Magnolia, where I think that was explored to a masterful level, where through Donnie's voiceover, when he talks about Martha, we want to create this kind of hectic feeling of moving, but always having her appearing, where the camera is following Donnie, and then it looks left, and here comes Martha, or this constant pushes towards the door, and her appearing. It was also about having that rhythm of paciness, and that would probably start with that voiceover of the theater play, and I think. It's not maybe direct reference, but I think there is a little bit of that in Trainspotting, I think, with the character. Sure, I think that somehow, that title was mentioned somewhere. And obviously it's a bit different world. It's way more stylized, I think.
Well, you have moments of real stylization in this as well, too. I think of the sort of like really strong amber top light in Donnie right after he's done drugs, like, right. And he's on the couch and sprawled out. Like, you have some moments which, like, you're not sure where you are anymore. You're not sure if this is like all in his head. So I definitely feel like there's some, Trainspotting, of course, has lots of stylization, but I felt like at moments you really leaned into it as well, too. You were really, like, not just what's a cool shot, but how can we stylize this and really try to have the cinematography underscore what's happening in the scene here, like visually, like with lighting. So I'm wondering, actually, a couple things I noticed in lighting with this. You were not afraid of making Richard look unflattering, like we're giving him some hard lighting and some deep shadows, and to making him feel a bit off and a bit weird. But what's interesting is that I felt that Martha, as a juxtaposition,
she glows.
She does. She really, she's, it's much more, like, not always, but she quite often much more flattering than Donnie. Yeah. So you have this juxtaposition between the two of them. Can you talk a little bit about your lighting approach between these two characters?
Yeah, I mean, we very quickly noticed when shooting the show that there was that element. And also, it's interesting because I think it was also the performance that brought that in. And Richard never looked up. Mm. He would always look down. He would always be like that. And it just felt wrong to then bring a highlight to him. Whereas with Martha, she's always looking up. She's always looking up to Donnie. He has this kind of, she has this flirtatious attitude to him, right?
Yes, it's affection. It's a look of affection, just like, constant, yeah.
And he, you clearly realize that he's a bit of a sucker for that. And like, he doesn't get it anywhere else. Which is obviously the show is very much about that. But I think it also reflects in how she presents herself, how she dresses. It's all very much sometimes over the top. And also kind of through the story, when he gets worse, when she's, in that sort of catatonic state on the at the bus station, at the bus stop. Yeah, I think it's a sort of happy accident between the performance and the story and where the story's set. And we kind of didn't want to fight it.
I really appreciate it because I feel like the show is about contrast. There's a lot of different sort of contrasts. There's a contrast between Donnie and Martha that goes on, and also with Terry. Terry also, there's a stark contrast between her, who seems to be very grounded and very like stable and very together.
Yeah.
And Donnie's always, you know, a bit manic or a bit frenetic. So you've got sort of like this orbit of characters, and each one of them has their, I want to say their own look. So as flattering as Martha is, it's not nearly as flattering, of course, as Terry. Terry is, you know, she positively glows and radiates, and she looks, incredible. Meanwhile, in a reverse shot, Donnie might just look, you know, completely crazed and out of his mind, but it all fits so nicely together. It fits, they're in the same world, but for whatever light that they find in those scenes, they have their own personality that's reflected. You've got all of this sort of like these contrasts, these people almost all occupying the same space, but also all in their same world. And was there certain intentions that as you're lighting this, that, you know, this particular character, they have to have a backlight, they have to look their best, they have to have their thing that makes them pop? Or what was your perspective going into that?
I think it was more reactions on set. And I wanted Terry to always look good. And I think I put more effort into bringing the light into her eyes, and it kind of felt instinctive in a way. But again, I would say sometimes it's a consequence of the story as well, the space and the story in a way. Like if I think about the scene in the underground where Donnie is like squashed under because he doesn't want to be there, we know he will in a second jump out, and he's sort of under the light, and we never thought this sort of position. Whereas Terry was just under this glowing tube, which almost gave her face, you know, when there is this close-up, when she almost talks in slow motion.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we actually shot it in slow motion.
just a little bit? Yeah.
Do you know, and there is something about her face in that close-up that really is very romantic, but he's afraid of it.
I keep thinking about this idea of contrast too. Like even in your framing, quite often the camera's looking up at Donnie. It's looking up at him. And usually when you're looking up, that's the powerful person. This is the person in power. And quite often looking down at Martha. And quite often when you're looking down, this is the person who's not in power. But obviously the power dynamics are completely different than what the camera portrays during this, which is really wonderful. I felt like Terry is the only character who, like, we're almost never doing anything but looking her straight in the eye. She's the only person who really feels like, I think, occupying and level in this world where Donnie has got this. It's interesting because he's always, I feel like, you know, he's down in the dumps. He's got these mental things going on. And Martha is also looking up into, like, you know, she's always aggrandizing herself. And I think that the framing of these characters really plays against the stereotypical notions that people usually have with framing characters a certain way. Was that conscious for you guys? Was it just a matter of characters or height? Did you talk about this in pre-production? How did you decide how to represent people on screen this way, or the characters, I should say?
I think it was more instinctive. And I never, for example, which is interesting because I would never hear from Veronica when setting the shot, oh, jib higher, if you know what I mean, when looking at Donnie. Like that was never, and she's quite conscious director in terms of visuals. If there's something she didn't feel is right, she would say it. Like she's definitely on the photographically conscious director. And I never got that from her. And I think the high angle on Martha quite often is imitating Donnie's point of view. But yeah, on Martha, it was never neutral. That's for sure. Like on Donnie, it was pretty much always camera low. And Terry, I would say, was pretty neutral.
The show feels like, I mean, just because of the Steadicam and the style and everything else, it feels like it might have been a very short production schedule. Was it a short production schedule? How long did it take you guys to make an episode on average for this?
I think we had about 6-7 scenes a day, which is not ideal. But on the other hand, we only shot about 3.5 pages a day. So we had about, I think,
10 days per episode. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, or just under, because we had a little bit more time to do episode 4.
Mm.
We happened to do about 20, 22 setups a day on a, 10-hour schedule.
Yeah, that's pretty respectable. That's getting a lot done. That's
great. Yeah. The only thing is you always have to kind of start and finish the scene, rather than when you have a scene that is just a 5-page dialogue. You know, you go through it quite quickly. It's when you kind of start establishing things and where they're going and where it starts and when it ends. I think that was a little bit more time consuming than just shooting longer dialogue scenes through and through. But it wasn't that bad.
Gotcha.
We probably did every take on Donnie was 9-10 take.
9-10 takes? Yeah. Well, yeah. You know.
Which was quite, like, I remember, I was like, we literally would do 8-10 takes on Donnie always. Yeah. But you got to give it to the creator of the show.
Yes, I imagine as such, and he probably knows exactly the way that he wants to do it. And it's very interesting when you've got the writer who's also the star and then a director, you know, and you all kind of having to collaborate together to get the performance and get the performance captured the way that, you know, the creator of the show wants it. I don't think that you ever had to do that many takes on Jessica, who plays Martha, of course, but I could be wrong. I have heard so many amazing comments about Jessica's performance as Martha, you know, even before I tried watching the show. There's a lot of people talking about, like, Emmy buzz for her. Her performance is so amazing. Tell me a little bit, like, when you're on set, if they've got scenes together and Richard's got to do 8 takes, that means sometimes that probably the rest of the cast, Jessica has to do 8 takes with him, do the whole thing. To be able to maintain the level of intensity and the level of stuff that's going on. You tell me, on set, was everyone blown away by Jessica and what she was able to do?
Oh, yeah. Like, she was incredible. I mean, Richard was also, like, I would say that they were both amazing in terms of how much they were giving.
Mm.
And, I mean, with Jess, she was just incredible from day one. You know, it was such a pleasure. And I think in the casting, I think Jess was number one from the start. Like, you know, you felt for her. You could feel it on set. And there's an even funny moment, because there's a scene where when Donnie goes to Martha's flat to kind of break up with her. And I remember everyone laughed because we were shooting this scene and I had the camera on Easy Rig, I think, at the time, very close to Martha's portrait. I just hear Richard saying, there's a line saying something like, I have to break up with you, looking at Martha. And I just do like a loud sigh, and she just completely loses it and starts laughing. And I don't know how it happened, but it was a funny moment where, you know, like, you really felt her performance and you were really, you know, in tune. Like, you know, you felt for her. You could feel it on set, like in the moments of where she kind of becomes a bit more humane. And then you would just laugh.
Yeah.
You couldn't, like, there was this moment. Yeah, I had to, like, sometimes I was definitely laughing under my nose when I was operating.
I bet, you know, it was probably very, very tough. Do you operate a lot yourself too, when you're, or do you work with an operator? How do you prefer to work with the camera operation?
I like operating. I mean, I think on the TV schedule, sometimes I wish I could see things clearly, because you just don't have time to, you know, to tweak things. So going between camera and the monitor,
yeah,
to watch playback, it can be a little bit exhausting.
For sure.
Just because you don't have time and you have to rush, and then you have to rush back to operate. But I do like it, and I was happy to do it myself. I would probably most of the time do it myself, unless I can't judge the lighting on a small monitor, you know?
Sure.
added pretty heavy lot on this show. So it was also, you kind of had to look at the monitor sometimes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that LUT. I assume that was made in prep. Did you guys have a long prep schedule to figure out the look and all of this? And did you test cameras and lenses? How did you come up with the look of Baby Reindeer?
I think Veronica was a little bit upset when I told her the lenses have been chosen before, and I don't know if I should say that loud. But,
all right, do you want us to cut that out?
No, I think she will laugh. I think there was a moment, because I really liked the lenses we went for it, and I thought they were perfect for the show. You know, we were talking about the sort of central compositions and stuff, and I wanted something that would fall apart a little bit towards the edges, because since it's all central compositions, we don't need that perfection. And also, they're very pretty lenses, but some, like, I've selected certain focal lengths up from the set that I thought was, they have quite their own character and they differ from focal length to focal length.
Hmm. So which lenses? Which lenses are these?
They're called RE-DNA LF. Lenses. So, like, they're the second design after they've done the DMAs for Alexa 65, and then they've done the version for LF. And they each own has a little bit different characteristic, but I kind of pushed for those lenses to be on the show, and I was very glad that they were available. And sort of when Veronica was saying, so when are we going to do a lens test, I was like, oh, what do you mean? Because I think these are the lenses. And she like, but I think, you know, we know each other. I know what she likes. It wasn't totally out of the protocol in a way. I wouldn't do it with a director that I've never worked with, probably. And also probably would like to discover the look. And that's great when you go through the process of testing lenses and finding the best lenses for the show. But I think at that point, I kind of knew that that would be the best tool. And to be honest, there was a shot in the show that we wanted to use a zoom lens. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we put that zoom lens on the camera, we looked at the monitor, we looked at each other and said, well, we're not even going there because it's such an obvious wrong choice. In terms of how suddenly the pub, it's the pub in Scotland in episode 4, suddenly that just became a different place. I think because we were shooting so long on one set of lenses and because they're so particular, suddenly sudden change immediately like brought this kind of reaction that we don't wanna go there. It just looks too clean, just looks like a different show suddenly.
Sure. Well, tell me a little bit about the LUT that you created for the show, or the heavy LUT look that you're talking about. Was that also from the post-process, and did you basically use that to monitor on set so you had an understanding then of how you wanted it to look? And I mean, there's a lot of earth tones, I feel like, and a lot of yellows and fun stuff. Yeah. But
we called them a decomposing body palette. And I think we found this, that was like a brief communicating with Debbie Burton, production designer. That was like you would call it earth tones. I think that's much more poetic description. Yes, it was a lot of yellow, brown, bit of green. Well, then color of Donnie, which is red. And he was talking from the beginning about red and green sort of being those two colors, almost like feeling the primary color, and then everything else falling into this world of brown and yellow and sort of greenish, yellowish colors.
It's a dynamic look that is stylized, and I think that what it really creates is every time you then have a moment that doesn't have that look really pops. Like, and I think particularly of like Martha, you know, under more or less natural light at the bus stop and things like that. There's certain moments and key things which then don't have that sort of palette and that look to it, and they very much, I think, stand out, you know, as contrast to the rest of the show. You know, Christoph, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I think that it's been wonderful to dive into Baby Reindeer here. Before we go, is there a place online that people can track you down? Do you Instagram or do you do anything like that? If someone wanted to, do you have a website? How can people find you if they want to find you?
Yeah, I have a website and Instagram. And Instagram is my name and last name.
Yeah, yeah.
And my website is christophtrojnar.com in Polish. I wish everyone... You can copy and paste it somewhere. Hopefully it works because it's a difficult...
Yeah, Google Translate works stuff. Wonders. Yeah. And you know, what we're going to do is we're going to put a link to your website and to your Instagram on the show notes for this episode over at camnoir.com. Christoph, thank you so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
All right, so that was Christoph Trojnar. Thanks so much for being on the show again. Great work on Baby Reindeer. God, it was such a great show and such good-looking work.
Great-looking show, yeah.
Yeah, really fantastic. So, Ben, it is time for our short end time of the show.
And now, short ends.
It's where we talk about our obsessions of the week. What are you into? What are you all about? It can be anything. What is your
Could be short anything. End?
It could be anything, yes.
Let's talk about my dick. No, I'm not going to talk.
Whoa, hey, this show took a hard right turn, one I was not expecting.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, you can put furniture on it, you can stain it,
you can sit up. Oh, your deck.
Deck, yeah. What did you think I said?
Thought you said something else. Not appropriate for polite podcasts.
No. We just got an explicit rating there for your misunderstanding when I was saying Yikes. I would talk about
the
deck where I like to sit in the backyard. No. So I almost want to ask anyone out here listening to the sound of my voice if they use this product. I have downloaded a long time ago onto my iPad and various devices a pre-visualization tool called Previs Pro. And I'm in the middle of breaking down a project to shoot it, and I always use Shot Designer, Hollywood Camera Works Shot Designer, and I think that basically, it's almost standard. Every director I know, if they use something like this, they use Shot Designer because it's a really fast way to make an overhead. You don't have to sit there and set stuff up for a long time. You don't have to fuss over how stuff looks.
You should buy stock in that company. The number of times you've mentioned it on this podcast.
I don't think they're publicly traded, but but anyway, I've had Previs Pro. I think it used to be called Hitchcock a long time ago. So it's a similar thing, but it's the idea is that you can make really fast storyboards. And so I hover around it a little bit, and it reminds me a little bit of a program I used to use called FrameForge 3D Studio Pro. And FrameForge
just rolls off the tongue.
I know. Well, I like the idea of FrameForge because you could set up a scene and you could set up all your camera angles and you could even make it optically correct for depth of field and do all kinds of stuff. What I found in practice was that FrameForge, although I know people who use it, Ben Kitai, who we've had on the show, he uses FrameForge. It's not a bad program. The thing is, I hate the lengthy setup of a scene, of like taking a really, really long time to kind of build the pieces, parts to make it. And I guess the reason I like Shot Designer is that there are no pieces, parts. It's like person here looking this way, person there looking that way, camera. If you need to show where lights are or the set, if you can easily bring in a JPEG if you have a set design that you're working with, or you know, whatever you want to do. It's like designed to be kind of a quick, sloppy way to figure your way through a scene and just kind of get over it. And I was hoping that Previs Pro would be that. So I actually went so far as to do like the 7-day free trial, and I'm like, I'm going to break down one scene in this. And I then proceeded to get outrageously frustrated with this program. Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen the results people get out of it, and they're really good. You can do really good work in it. And somebody once asked me, like, what's a great app that'll help you learn how to do storyboards? And my answer, my snarky, glib answer was, take a class on, you know, like, learn to draw. You know, like, that's
great.
There isn't a shortcut to understanding how to draw. And I feel like that's sort of what Previs Pro promises and to a degree delivers. Like, it kind of gives you generic people who are all sort of dressed in a specific way. You can bring in other 3D elements. It automatically connects you to 3D marketplaces where you can buy or find free things. If you're looking for a background, like you just need a mountain or a sky or a cityscape or something, you can easily pull those in. Like, there's all this stuff that makes it look really cool, but I ultimately found the learning curve to be extremely frustrating. And I think that at this point in my life, I can say I'm pretty good at picking these things up. I'm not, there are people who are better. There are people who are worse. But when I find myself banging my head against the previs program, like the whole point of the previs program
was to make, save you time and make your life easier. Yeah. Not so make it harder.
I'm asking anyone in our audience, if anyone uses Previs Pro, I kind of want to know what got you over the hump. Also, if anyone from Previs Pro is listening to us, because I think their product looks really cool. Like it looks like it would be an awesome thing for a director to have. I have a sequence that I was trying to design that I thought, hey, maybe I'll try and do it in this. And after dicking around with it for a couple of days, I was finally like, I don't know. This is like, as we say, the juice ain't worth the squeeze. I don't think it's because I'm just familiar with Shot Designer. I think it's because the basic concept of Shot Designer maybe thinks more like I think. Maybe that's all it is. And this is going to be no good for me. But I was, you know, even thinking it would be a good thing to have this. And then like, if you could use this to thumbnail out a sequence and then get a real storyboard artist like Tony Liberatore, who we've had on the show before, you have a real storyboard person take your thumbnails and turn them into something better. Like that would be cool. But also if for budget stuff or a quick way to bang out an idea. And I guess that's where I'm hitting my head against the wall with this, is it's like, if it's going to be all app-based, it should be much more accessible than it is. And the problem, the FrameForge problem for me was, I don't want to spend 3 hours building a virtual set so that I can, you know, bang off the three angles that I need in that set. I just want to basically kind of go like,
you want to drag, drop, and go. Yeah.
Like I want something that is like almost a brainstorming tool, like something that gets me to the creative part fast, that doesn't ask me to invest a lot of time in setting up before the creative part.
Yeah. You're going to enroll in like a 101, a 201, and a 301 university course to use this app.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's the thing too. Like I've broken down an entire feature in Shot Designer before, and it still takes a long time.
Sure.
Because obviously even after you've set up all the shot, set up your location, it's then you have to think, where would I put the camera? Where are the actors going to go? What's the basic idea of the scene? And that's the real work. The real work should not be in like building anything or creating it from scratch. That being said, like this thing has like tools where like it has an alternate NAR shooting mode where you could like go to a location and hold your phone up and take pictures, point it in the exact direction that you want it pointed in, and it'll put your virtual characters in virtual space and you can move around them like James Cameron making friggin' Avatar. That sounds great to me. It's just in practice, I'm finding it onerous. So really, this is a cry for help. If anyone from Previs Pro is listening to us, or anyone who listening to us uses Previs Pro, I'd love to have you on and talk about what you're doing. This is not gotcha obnoxious journalism. This is a genuine interest in using a tool that I think would be great if I could figure out how to make it work. And I'm saying this because I feel like if I'm having a problem with it, I can't be the only one.
Yeah. That sounds fair.
So Ilya, what are you all about this week? Which is what you always say to me.
It's true. Okay. So like you, I've got a little bit of a neg. I've got a neg on an app, and I can't be too neg on it. It's Blackmagic. So Blackmagic has an app that already exists for the iPhone called Blackmagic Camera for iPhone or Blackmagic Camera for iOS, something to that effect. They now have a version for Android, and it's called Blackmagic Camera for Android. So I was looking forward to this. I've been looking forward to for a little while. I knew it was coming. I have an Android 13 phone, and I went to go download it.
That's your problem right there, but go on.
That is part of the problem. I went to download it, and I got a message that it's not available for my phone. And I was like, well, that's really weird, because I've got, you know, the Sony Xperia 1 Pro, like, you know, top of the line flagship Sony Android camera. Yeah, it was only made for Samsung and Google phones. It was not made for any other phone out there, at least not yet. I believe that Blackmagic may get there, but I think that, you know, and look, it's got to be hard for Android developers because there's so many different companies out there making phones. I have to imagine the
also,
level
also
of,
I have to say, they have to talk to Android users. And have you ever talked to one of those people? Oh wait, yeah, you're one of them.
I'm one of those. I talk to those people every single day, and I will tell you that actually most of the world is an Android user, not an iPhone user. I'm sorry. Sorry to tell you. So you're in a small bubble here of iPhone users. Most people, Android users.
Anyway. I'm guessing that Blackmagic, though, they released that for the iPhone, knowing that, like, you know, more creative professionals are probably rocking an iPhone than an Android.
Maybe. That could very well be. I think that Apple's made a real concerted effort to try to bill the iPhone as a tool for creatives. So I think that they're feeding into that. What I did find particularly interesting, though, is inside the Play Store, which is the app store for Google, lots and lots of ads for Filmic Pro, which will totally work on my phone, but like...
Filmic Pro is really good, by the way.
So Filmic Pro, though, but you type in Blackmagic camera app and you get Filmic Pro ads, which I think is really interesting. Now, granted, I couldn't see the correct Blackmagic for Android inside the App Store, but boy, do they want me to download Filmic Pro. And so I have heard a bunch of rumors and stories about Filmic Pro, including like being in some sort of trouble or changing their business model.
Oh, really? Possibly.
Yeah, I'd heard a bunch of rumors about it. I guess a venture capitalist company had gotten involved. I don't have the full story on that yet, but clearly they're seeing competition, I think, in a way that they probably haven't ever seen before with Blackmagic getting into this space. So if you want
more... Blackmagic app is free, too. That's a big thing. It's like Filmic Pro is a paid app.
It's a paid app. And I have not...
I bought the full version of it probably like 7 years ago, and then they changed it after I got it. I hate it when they do this. After I paid for it, they turned it into a subscription thing. And they were like, you can keep the paid version, but we're not going to update it anymore. We're only going to update the subscription one. And I'm like, I think I'm good.
So yeah, I guess I'm curious then. Have you tried them both? Have you done a side by side?
Yeah, I haven't like done a shootout with them. I'll say this: I think the Blackmagic app is laid out a lot better than Filmic, in terms of just intuitive usability. In terms of like not buttons showing up where your finger is going to be anyway, or you know, like because like when you're dealing with a smartphone screen, it's just, you know, it's big for a phone, but it's not big for a screen, and so it's easy for it to get cluttered and ugly, and I feel like Blackmagic's pretty good at that.
And here's I guess my larger point about all this. I was looking to download it because I really kind of wanted to try to, in some ways, see what was the maximum I could get out of a phone. At the end of the day, it is only a phone, and I feel like the promise of these apps is that, oh, your phone is capable of so much more. And I don't really believe that. I think that my phone is actually pretty truncated. It's pretty limited in what it can do. And I don't think it takes a rocket science to figure this out, but it does take a point of reference. And so to be absolutely as fair as possible, there is all these manual modes on my Sony phone. There's all of these pro creators, pro this, pro that, which does involve manual control of it. But still, even when I try to eke out the absolute best in a way that I'd say would not be practical for anyone to shoot with it, it's still, at the end of the day, a phone. It's just a phone. It's not actually...
I'd say you haven't been watching Michael Cioni's videos on his Strata channel where he does shootouts with phones or shows how to kit up. It's an iPhone, I'm sorry to say, but he kits up an iPhone to do professional shooting on it.
I've seen some of Michael Cioni's stuff, and I think Michael Cioni's stuff is very savvy and smart. Would most people really want to do that and go through all those steps? I'll use the exact same words to him that he used to me. I feel like that's creating an awful lot of extra effort and work and such to make a tool that arguably costs as much as lower end cameras that natively will give you a better experience. So, yeah. And it's interesting because some people out there make such a big deal about phones being the real entryway into filmmaking. And for some people, it truly is.
Well, it's something that you already have.
It's something that you already have.
Yeah. So if I was in middle school or high school today and I wanted to make a movie, I would grab a smartphone and I would shoot and maybe edit on the smartphone. And that's how I would do it all. To me, that makes perfect sense.
I think that as soon as you pass that point, as soon as you are taking it seriously, this is something that you want to charge someone money for, something that you want to level up, something you want to get better at. You also have to, you know, how would you feel if the guy who you hired to like pave your driveway only showed up with like the cheapest things that they could find at the local home improvement store instead of actually like a cement mixer? There are certain tools that are correct for the job and certain ones that are not.
Well, I remember years and years ago, our mutual friend Liam Finn hired me to do camera, which is not really something I do very often. It was on a thing in Vegas that involved lots of golfing. And I had just upgraded to the iPhone. I want to say it was the 11. It might have been earlier than that, but it was one of the early ones that had slow motion. And the camera I was filming on, which I believe was the Canon 5D, did not have slow motion. And there were a couple of times when we were filming where I was like, oh, I'm going to put my phone right on the ground, set it to 240 frames per second, put the sun like burning our guy into a silhouette and have him do a slow motion drive on the golf course. And it looked great. And that stuff like made the cut. Now, like 99% of what I shot on that project was on the Canon, but the stuff that I did on the phone was pretty cool. And that was a much older phone than the newer ones have. You know, you can film ProRes. Chione's point, by the way, is like, why is Apple even allowing you to film natively to ProRes? Why is it giving you these tools? And, you know, I think about the first film I ever made. I mean, actually, the first short I ever made was on literally Super VHS. But the second short I made was on black and white Super 8. And I thought I was red hot shit for shooting on film. And
you were red hot shit for shooting on film.
I was. I'm quite proud of that short. But I think about, like, on that short, I probably spent $1,200 or something on film stock processing,
yeah,
all that stuff. It's a lot of money for, like, I was 19 years old when I did it. And your phone, granted, also whatever digital SLR, mirrorless SLR camera you would get at the entry level stage, you know, you're going to get a couple of memory cards or one memory card, and that's all you're ever going to film on. And so you're never going to pay for that stuff. But
I'd argue that someone for $300 for a weekend could rent all the stuff that they would need then and be way better off.
Probably. But I think that what Michael is kind of probing with that stuff is, why is Apple doing this? And, you know, Apple doing it, by the way, if they achieve any success with it, is going to force the Android people to do the same thing. I actually had a question, too. Like, if you had one of those, the phones that Red Camera made, could you put the Blackmagic app on the red phone, or is it too obsolete?
Yeah, it's too obsolete now. They I don't think have had an Android update for that phone in a long time. So it's not supported, sorry to say. It would be cool. But no.
If you're listening to us, Nikon, get on it.
You know what? Actually, probably wouldn't be a bad thing for Nikon to figure out. I think people might go for a Nikon phone, for sure.
A Nikon phone sounds a lot more better to me than a Red phone, even though it would literally be the same thing now.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway. So, Ben, I think that's just about going to do it for another episode. Who do we have to thank?
I mean, well, first and foremost, we should thank Alana Cody, who's got this interview. And I have a very intriguing interview coming up from someone who I guarantee you our audience knows who it is. And this person's never been a cinematographer before. Whoa, blew my mind.
I'm on that interview, too. So I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, it's someone we've wanted to have on the show for years, which is
very,
great.
Very cool. I'm very excited about that. But we have a bunch of cool stuff. So we've got that coming up. But anyway. Thanks to Alana Cody for lining that up and making it all happen. We got to thank Ben Katz, our kick-ass intrepid editor. And then last but not least, we got to thank Kay Zalatracci, who composed every scrap of music that you've heard on this podcast. Go to musicbykays.com. Check out his work. Hire him to compose a score for you, for God's sakes.
Ben, where can people find you if they want to look you up outside of this podcast?
Outside of this podcast, you should check out benrock.com, my home away from home, where I keep all of my Ben Rock information that you can look up. Ilya, where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. So Ben, that just about does it. You want to take us out?
That's a wrap. Too cheesy.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.